wondering that there's something underneath all of this. I went to a government school and I wasn't too happy about it. That was part of being divided. I feel that way. I have nothing. When I was in ninth grade, I had my brother write a letter so that I could try to get back home to our people. It was a sad thing. And this is how I feel about the corporations that they started. It's bad. Nothing good of it come. Today, up to this date, I have yet to benefit from the Haida Corporation. And when I signed up my family, there was an incident. I wanted to be known. I took two kids under my name. I adopted two kids. And I signed them up for the Haida Corporation, and they put them at large. I never fought the issue. They just automatically took them and put them at large. And I adopted those two kids, I gave them my name, and I wanted them in the Haida Corporation. We didn't know what we were getting into at the start, but I wanted them to be under my name. I wanted them to have the shares. They have Sea Alaska shares. I'm proud of it that they got something. But when we plan, my wife and I talk about it. I said, I'll give my shares to my daughter. She's 11 years old now. This is how I feel about things. We shouldn't have to add new things. We already have enough on our hands. We should think of our kids. We're all getting older, and how we're going to run it is we take care of them. We are the doctors of our own children. If we don't prescribe the right medicine, they're not going to make it too far by themselves. So that's all I got to say right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peel. Thank you very much.
My name's Renee Vigil, and I'm staying at 3631 East G, Tacoma, 98404. And I'm a member of the 13th Region, and I wasn't old enough when my parents put me in the 13th Region, but I feel that the 13th Region should be abolished now, and that all the members in the 13th Region be allowed to join their native corporation from up north. And that's what all I'd like to say, and I'd like you to look into that.
Okay, thank you, sir. Thank you.
Hello, as you can see, I'm not a native Alaskan. However, I would like to give some testimony that might be of use to you, Judge Berger. Okay. My name is Toby Thaler. I'm an attorney with the Evergreen Legal Services Native American Project. And the relevant experience I have is that in 1976 and 77, I was a legal intern with the Dillingham, Alaska Office of Alaska Legal Services. Our office handled a number of matters of interest to particularly Yupik Eskimo and Aleut clients in the Bristol Bay region. That included limited entry permits under Alaska state law and Alaska native allotments under federal law that were being applied for at that time in the rush as the Native Claim Settlement Act was implemented. I think that my experience gives me some insight into the kind of problems that will be faced by the Native people as the shares become alienable in 1991, and I would like to use those two areas of law that I mentioned as good analogies for what can happen and why it's a serious problem. With regard to the fishing, the history of fishing in Bristol Bay is that before the Russians came, the people subsisted on the fishery and also traded the fish for other goods. When the Russians and then the Americans came, the fishery developed into a commercial industry, but the pattern that developed was that the native people continued to be the primary gatherers of the resource and were sellers to the canneries. When the state of Alaska began to implement the limited entry program, they based acquisition of a limited entry permit on past experience in the industry, so that was good for the native people in the sense that they had the experience in the industry, therefore they were able to obtain the majority of the permits. Unfortunately, the way the program is set up, as in most Western legal structures, the permits are a personal piece of private property, hence alienable. Beyond that, even as an aside, the limited entry permits were difficult to use by other members in the family. They were so attached to the person that held them that it was difficult to have somebody else in the family use them if you were unable to in any particular season. The bureaucratic structure for permitting that was very complicated. I had a few cases where I would try and temporarily transfer permits and it was difficult. But then once somebody dies, then the permit doesn't, it goes into the estate and hopefully one of the children would get it. But what started happening when I was there 10 years ago and what I understand is continuing to happen is that because the right to fish has been transformed into a personal property right, the right to take the fish has gradually filtered out of the native community. And the cost of the permits has escalated so high that the temptation to sell those limited entry permits becomes great. When I was working in Bristol Bay, a drift gillnet permit had a market value of $10,000 or less. I believe that the cost of a limited entry permit for Bristol Bay today is far in excess of that amount.
More than $100,000
or more, correct. And there are other permits, for example, the Chignik Bay purse seine fishery, which are much more valuable. The number of permits is less, and the net take of the fishery is much higher. So in an original sense, the native village was well off because the permits were held largely by the people in the village. But it's like a diode. The flow can only go in one direction. Once a permit leaves the community, it's almost impossible for it to come back in because the capital does not exist for it to come back, let alone the willingness by a seller in Seattle to sell back to the village. It's like asking people in Western Washington to give back the ceded treaty lands. The other area, the native allotments, highlights a different aspect of the problem, and in addition to the alienability of the property, it creates a tension between the community and the individual that owns the property. When the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed, it provided for extinguishment of rights under the Native Allotment Act, which itself had provided for 160-acre allotments to individual Native Alaskans upon a showing of use and occupancy of a specific piece of property. The cutoff date was perceived as a time before which all these people had to get their applications in, so there was a flood of applications. The Legal Services, Alaska Legal Services Corporation, spent a tremendous amount of resources gathering applications and affidavits before the deadline, and much litigation ensued over the program and the deadlines and what was use and occupancy still being decided. I believe a case was just decided in the Ninth Circuit. And what happens, the Settlement Act and the Native Claims Settlement Act, ANCSA, provided for village selections. and there was a large overlap between the village selections and the allotments because those were the same places that the people in the community tended to use. So what happens is, in a lot of villages, you find a native allotment owned by an individual surrounded or as an island in the village selection. The village selection, which eventually became deeded to the village corporation, was community property and was held by the community, and that was a continuation of general cultural practice that the land was held by all. And the Allotment Act took one small portion of that cultural practice, that is, that one family would have a campsite or an area that they used and that others wouldn't use it without their permission, took that use right and translated it into a fee simple, and for all intents and purposes, so that that individual acquired the right to alienate that property outside of the community, so that instead of passing within the community and the family, it all of a sudden becomes a monetary value that can be passed out, and that has already started to cause tensions between the communities and the holders of individual allotments. I believe both cases, the limited entry situation and the Alaska Native allotment situation, in microcosm, are a prognostication of what will happen if the shares of ownership of the village village and regional corporations are allowed to become alienable in 1991. I believe it's going to destroy the fabric of the communities if the ownership of the property that has been held since time immemorial by the community is allowed to be fragmented further and alienated in a legal sense. Already in 1977, when I was there, I could see the outside interests taking control of the corporations. The Native Alaskans did not have the same educational background and opportunity to know how to run the corporations. They did have the sense to hire people from back east, I saw this, to run the corporations, and I believe that outside interest in the capital of the corporations will be accentuated and exacerbated by alienation of the shares. I'm willing to answer any questions you might have about my experience and perceptions of the situation, should you have any.
I notice you've got something in writing there. Were you going, is that something you were going to leave with me?
No, this is your material.
If
you wish, I can write up my thoughts and leave it with you if it would be of use.
It would be, actually. The question of limited entry permits and the flow of limited entry permits from the native to the non-native sector has come up at village meetings, and your evidence is very helpful on the point. And allotments have come up, too, and the tensions they create.
It's interesting to compare the Alaska limited entry permits with the situation in Western Washington, where by judicial decision the right is held by the community and cannot be alienated unless the entire community makes that decision, and that's the way it should be.
You mean under the Bolt decision?
Right. Yeah. But not just under the Stevens Treaties, but under all treaties in the lower 48, it's universally held that those rights are held by the community, and only in special circumstances is it divided.
It isn't an item of personal property.
It is not an item of personal property. The community,
and it is not alienable.
It's not alienable except by the community as a whole. The community as a whole makes decisions as to how the individuals will partake and So tribes have licensing procedures just like the state does, and if you violate the code imposed on use of the resource by the community, then you can lose that right.
Right. Well, thanks very much, sir.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Oh,
okay. Well, then let's bring them back. And could we have your name, sir, and address?
I'll give you my address with the lady over there.
Okay.
You talked for 20 minutes. What were you trying to say?
Say that again.
What? I said you talked for 20 minutes. What were you trying to say?
I was saying that I don't believe that the shares of the corporations that were distributed under the Settlement Act should be allowed to flow out of the community in 1991. They should not be alienable. Even beyond that, I'm suggesting that the Settlement Act was incorrect in distributing shares at all, that the ownership of property in the settlement should have been retained by the communities and not distributed to individuals.
Thank you. I myself see the Alaska Native Land Settlement claim as an abject failure. I have not seen any good of it. In due time, we will lose all our rights, all our lands, and our own cultures will go too.
Well, maybe I was being too legalistic in my testimony, but that's essentially what I was saying.
Yeah, I think both of you gentlemen have reached the same conclusion. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Mary, and I live at 4544 7 Northeast, Seattle, Washington, 98105. I'm kind of nervous, too. I have been reading the papers, and I find a lot of negative input, and that's what they want us to do. We don't need to feel that way. There's a lot of demands. There's a lot of things that we can come up with, and I'm sure we had a lot of experience with a lot of negative situations that arise with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Anyway, what I would like to come up with, I came over here unprepared, but I feel I have some input to put in. I think that our corporation should hire a commodity trading advisor, one of them that are experienced.
What corporation is that?
Chugiak's Alaska Corporation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I find that they're worried about whether our corporation will go broke. And I think us stockholders shouldn't even worry about that. We have the rights to worry, yes, but I think there are more demands than to worry and fret about it and let known to our corporation and possibly give them some positive input about what we should really work at. Now, I really think that they should hire a professional, skilled person to watch out for our account. The accounts that come in, instead of possibly they may end up giving us only $10 if we decide to sell. This doesn't mean that I want to sell. This only means that some of the stockholders may decide to sell without even knowing what they're doing. In other words, they would eventually sell, get all excited, and say, wow, we're going to get a profit. Then they find out and they're disappointed that they don't have a profit. Anyway, I think they should have more technical and fundamental factors to observe up to date and monitor those things, you know, that come up, like charts and stuff and so forth, you know, highly computerized. Because I feel that many of us stockholders that have land don't even have no proof of papers to say that we own land somewhere and that land may be valuable. In other words, 100 shares. Yes, we have 100 shares. We have 100 shares with our corporation and another corporation. 200 And for those at large, probably have only 100 shares, which is acceptable, but there is something that I feel leery about. And what it is there's a lot of land that in Alaska that may be detrimental to a lot of you that sell out and may end up with a land that may be a swamp or a rock. See what I'm getting at? There may, the currencies I'm speaking of will amount to our corporation if they work it out right. But it has to have an input from our shareholders. I'm speaking of metal, I'm speaking of whatever they have on that land. We can't just go out and sell our land and not even know what's on that land. There may be oil on it, you know. What I'm trying to say is we go and sell our land, or we restrict our land, we'll eventually end up with land that is given to us that isn't even worth it. But our corporation should look into that, that they will be able to benefit from it, and also we benefit from it. More so, our shareholders need to look into that too. It's a matter of losing money or gaining money. It's not the point. What's the point is saving our land in Alaska to the best of our ability for our future. If they choose to sell it, that's fine. But they gotta know what they're selling before they get into it. It can be dramatic and an instant thing to all of us, you know. Anyway, what I'm trying to say, it's safer and more profitable way to invest is to have a professional watch over your account, our account, 100% of the time. And what does it take a professional skilled person? We don't need one that's unskilled. Because many of that, I think, is going to come up with a lot of, I really feel that it's going to come up with yens, which is Japanese, Swiss, which is Swiss money, dashis. That's what they mean about another corporation that will come in and take a corporation. They have the money to take it, they will. I could say more, but like I say, I had a short notice and I didn't look into too much of it. But I feel it can be a severe repercussion to a lot of us globally. I hope we just do as best as we can in the way of, you know. All we have to be is prepared. And this is the starting point. That's all I gotta say.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Berger, I've been following your hearings all through the state of Alaska, and I've been reading about all the issues through the Alaska Native News Service magazine, and I feel that the issues as presented through your commission has been very interesting and covers the issues very clearly and plainly. I'm only sorry that so many of our Alaskans living down here did not have the information available to them so that they could respond to the problems they are going to be facing in the coming years. My name is Margaret Tillman. I live at 9514 4th Northeast, Seattle, Washington, 98115. I am a product of both cultures. I lived during the early part, before the Alaska Native land claims became an issue. And I have lived here in Seattle for over 35 years. I feel that I have been exposed to both cultures and used and utilized both cultures to my advantage. And I feel that this was made available to any Native that is capable of producing a more productive life. I was a member of the Alaska Native group here, the Tlingit and Haida Indians of Alaska, Washington chapter, for 15 years. During that time, I held a position as vice president. The main purpose of this group was to be included in the Tlingit and Haida Indian land claims, which preceded the Alaska Native land claims. The people in the lower 48 were not included in this. The language did not have provisions for the people living in the lower 48. And so this was the purpose of the Tlingit and Haida Indians of Alaska Washington chapter. And it was through their efforts that they were included in the Tlingit and Haida land claims and thus included in the Alaska Native land claims following the Tlingit and Haida land claims. That the terms of the land claims has been questioned by so many people is known to all of us, and the fact that there are many issues that we have to consider is known to a lot of our people, even though they are not possibly as well informed as some of the attorneys that give out information. I have prepared a statement here, and the reason I've written this is because it's always so difficult to follow through on issues, and I've been following all this. I have read everything that has been written by the Alaska Native Review Commission and feel that the part that I'm going to give is the one that is most pertinent to me. My remarks will be directed to the goals stated below of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the results of the Sea Alaska Corporation business operation response to these goals. The first goal: preserve and protect Native lands and culture. The second goal: enable Alaska Natives to realize economic benefits. The third goal: benefit future generations. The restricted time of 20 years from inception until 1991 of the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act was provided to give opportunity to the Natives to develop educated and trained leadership for the purpose of managing their economy through the development of business operations and resources granted by the Act. It was anticipated that by 1991, the Natives would be proficient enough to operate and regulate corporations, resources, and their economy. Whether the transition from the restrictive control of the Act to the release of the land, resources, and voting rights to the control of the Natives after the remaining 7 years is questionable. That the goals are not being met is voiced by the discontent among the Sea Alaska shareholders regarding corporate rights of voting, participation in the control of management of the Sea Alaska operation. excessive funds are expended for election campaigns to perpetuate a majority of the board of directors in office, many of the shareholders are not aware that votes are manipulated through discretionary voting practices. Nepotism is practiced in the election process. Corporate staffing, educational benefits, and considerations for the development of resources. The opportunity to participate in the development of business operations, community projects, and the development of resources has been denied educated and trained shareholders through professional jealousy. The expertise they have acquired will make too evident the lack of training and knowledge in a majority of the board members. It is questionable whether significant progress has been made to draw the Alaska Native into a more beneficial economy since the act was implemented 12 years ago. The existing situation is exemplified by the following excerpt from the Sea Alaska Shareholder Information Handbook. Reflected are the 1984 operations of the subsidiaries purchased and supposedly operated by Sea Alaska Corporation. Space limits the presentation to 1 year. These are the lists of the subsidiaries they have bought and the total number of employees that they employ and a number of Sea Alaska shareholders that are employed and what that number, the percentage of the number that they have of the shareholders and the earnings that they make, made in 1984, and the profit or loss. The Alaska Brick Company, they have a total of 242 employees. 21 are shareholders of Sea Alaska. That's only 9%. Their earnings for 1984 was $21.3 million. The profit was $3.7 million. Pacific West Barge Company, they have a total of 92 employees. 7 are shareholders. 8% is the number is all that they have. $9.4 million that they made in 1984. They have a profit of $400,000. The other corporation or subsidiary is Ocean Beauty Seafoods. They have 1,435 employees. Of that, only 131 are shareholders. That's only 9%. $72.5 million in 1984 they made. They lost $100,000. Sea Alaska Timber Company, they have total employees 31, shareholders 9. They're hiring the most number, even though they're a small operation, it's 29%. Their earnings was $10.1 million. And they lost $200,000. The total number of employees, that's all we have to date. In all the companies, it's 1,800. Of that, only 168 are Sea Alaska shareholders. Now tell me, does that show that they're utilizing our people to operate the businesses that they have started or own? Or are operating. $9.3 million, $9.38 is the percentage of the people that they have. That's the total percentage. $113 million point three is what they made in 1984. Of that, they account for only $3.8 million. There are other investments. There's no stated earnings for these or hiring practices. They don't say how much they made or whatever. They invested this amount of money though. United Bank of Alaska, $2.7 million. Soheo, that's an oil company. I can't think of all of the names of it. I should have written it out. 1.7 million, Alaska Drilling, 500,000. Then the Kluwak Island Dock Company, they invested $9 million there, and the Sea Alaska share payments on that is 1.6 million. Substantial benefits are not reflected either economically or financially to the shareholder. An educated examination of the financial reports for 12 years of operation by Sea Alaska Corporation would be indicative of a like situation. This is what I meant by that, is that their financial reports for 12 years shows the same results, where they're making a lot of money, they're not hiring enough people, and somebody's getting it, but it's not the shareholders. To continue in the same vein is a remark from page one of the Sea Alaska Shareholder Information Handbook as follows. This is the handbook that they send us, and this is the remark they made themselves, the board of directors, as follows. Some inefficient management practices in the corporation's day-to-day operations of headquarters and subsidiaries, and some losses from settlements of various business disputes and agreements, makes the shareholder wonder if there will be land, resources, or even corporate benefits available in 1991. This is their own remark. It's here verbatim. And you begin to wonder if they admit themselves that they have inefficient management practices, what's going to be available in 1991? Many shareholders are unaware that assets have been utilized as collateral for bank loans. Page 33 and 34 of the Sea Alaska Corporation 1983 annual report. Listed under long-term obligations are property and equipment, notes payable, buildings, deed of trust secured by land, obligations under capital leases. Unknown to the shareholder is the fact that the above mentioned obligations are subject to recall by the banks or other institutions for immediate payment. This is the very same situation that the government was trying to avoid by granting 20 years to make a qualified transition from their control to the control of the natives. The terms of the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act was implemented to protect and prevent the loss of our resources and our heritage. Initially, there were 15,800 natives in the Sea Alaska Corporation. The corporation received $200 million. Of this, $100,000 was distributed to the villages and shareholders at large. What happened to the rest? Many shareholders are of the opinion that an exhaustive investigation should be made to determine if the funds were used wisely, judiciously, and economically. The evidence that the shareholder is not benefiting is very obvious. Many shareholders talk of selling their stock in 1991. For myself, the stock represents the last vestige of my Indian heritage. I do not intend to sell it. It will be the remainder to my grandchildren that they too are descendants of a proud Indian heritage. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mrs. Tillman, very much.
Excuse me, I wanted to ask Mrs. Tillman something.
All right.
I wondered.
Could we have your name, ma'am? Do you
Margaret
mind?
Margaret Maloney Merrick.
Please,
1404 Valley View Drive, Puyallup, 98373. I was wondering, with all that information you got through your goings on the trips up to Southeastern Alaska or whatever, what was your coming thought of what would be decided on how this land should be protected by other natives? You didn't give any kind of say what you thought you would like the protection of native land for the native people.
You mean you're asking me what I would?
Uh-huh. I mean, not protection,
here's the situation.
Uh-huh.
I'm no longer involved in the Indian community problems. I've been retired for some time. But I have kept up with the information that has been coming through.
Uh-huh.
What I'm saying here is that beginning with day one of 1991, the corporations should have been working towards the day that the government would give up the control of protecting our lands, our resources, and our voting rights. They haven't done it. It hasn't been done. I'm not pointing the finger at anyone.
Oh, I see. I just wondered.
They are the only ones that can determine now what they can do for our people. And there was a young lady who said that we should hire people who are educated and business people who are capable of making the judgments that will enable us to keep our resources, our land, and whatever benefits that are left to us. There's only 7 years, now it's 6 years left to us. Mm-hmm. And if we don't make the change now to put people in there that are educated, that can give our boards of directors direction in resolving the problems and trying to save what little we have left so that we can maintain what remnant of our culture is left also. If these people don't realize that that is their job, we'd better turn around and get some people in there that will do it.
Do you think, like the government, if we set bylaws so that they wouldn't turn them around and take things away from us, do you think that government could stand, be able to do it for us, or we should just divide up in a bunch of groups like we have now?
I'll give you an example. There's one village corporation. It's surprising. I even keep track of what goes in the town I came from. I came from Klawak. I don't belong to their village corporation, but I have relatives that live there and belong. When they started out, their money and their resources were being wasted. They still are to a certain extent. But they managed to get in some people on the board of directors who were not too proud to say, we don't know how to run our business of our city and our corporate. They have a store that is a cooperative. If you will teach us so we can learn how to run our own business, then we'll be able to take it over and run it in time. So they hired somebody who knows the business, and they are running that business for them, and it's becoming a successful business. That's just a small part of what you should do with the corporations. It isn't a crime, and it isn't anything to be ashamed of to say, I don't know it.
Really?
Tell me so that I can improve it and change it.
Yeah.
Well, instead, our people, we're a very loyal people. We want to keep our relatives in office. I haven't anything against the boards of directors or whatever. I'm related to a lot of them. But we keep them in through loyalty rather than because they're capable. We need capable people. We have some already, and they won't use them. until we begin to learn to use the people we have to run our businesses and our lives, technically, we will lose what we have. You know, we started losing our, they talk a lot about the culture and heritage of your people. We started losing that way back when the Russians found Alaska and when the Spanish people and the English people came up and began filtering into our society. There's a book written on it, it's called Lost Heritage. We started losing it little by little. And we're not the only ones. All the major Indian civilizations have lost their heritage. And if we can save a little bit of it, that's all we can do.
Yeah, that's right. But also that I wanted to know why, like, the corporations have so many, like, villages, and then they give them the allotted amount of money, you know, to work with. But they don't do nothing. Like, some of the villages aren't adequate people to put their put the money into business or whatever. And this way we're going to lose it all if we let, we just let the whole work stay in corporations. If we put it all into one, I think it would work even better because the other people will help each other. Like, if you are, if we all pray together, we'll stay together. It's just that way. And people aren't going to, if they have somebody to help, that the ones that are, they might be not educated enough to help other people in other places, then they're going to just take over with their allotted money, what they're using to educate somebody else and somebody else, and then it's just a vicious circle of educating, and not, maybe they don't want, they won't get nowhere.
The surprising thing about it was the attorney that worked with the Clinkett and Hyde land claims, his name was Weisbrot. He came from a prestigious law firm in Washington, Weisbrot, Weisbrot, and Weisbrot. He said that when they were selling the Clinkett and Hyde land claims, he said, it's